Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
A wide-ranging interview which starts on a small farm in Uganda where our guest of today was born and grew up, followed by a very traditional, or should I say modern, input-heavy agrochemical agronomy education, which led to a huge delusion with agrochemicals and hybrid seeds, which led to a deep dive, and that continues until today, into the world of agroecology, regeneration, seed banks, etc. This story could have easily stopped there. Our guest could have, between brackets, just focused on restructuring agriculture education systems in Uganda and the rest of East Africa, because also there is a lot to do. But no, he got involved in the slow food movement, a global movement of over 1 million people fighting for good, clean and fair food, which was started in 1989 in Bra, Italy, by Carlo Petrini, who led the movement for 33 years. And now, since 2022, this movement is led by a smallholder farmer from Uganda who got disillusioned by agrochemicals. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode, today with a farmer, agronomist, activist and the current president of Slow Food International, a global movement involving millions of people in over 160 countries, working to ensure everyone has access to good, clean and fair food. So welcome to the show. And to start with a personal question, we always like to ask at the beginning, and obviously asking also in this way how it led you to an organization as Slow Food. What led you to focus on food and soil and regeneration? What has been your path, let's say, towards that?
Thank you so much. And thanks for hosting me. Since my childhood, I've been part of the farming system. I'm from a family of farmers, smallholder farmers in Uganda, and I've been going to the farm with my parents to grow food to sustain our needs, both financially but also in terms of food security. So I have been observing what's happening on our farm, what's happening on other farms, and I've always wanted to look at a system that is not so expensive to the farmer, and also a system that can provide food at all times without destroying the planet, without destroying the soil, and also without causing harm to those who produce it. Because I saw how my mom was struggling with producing food, how we work together on the farm. And I said, I want to do to be a farmer, but I want to work in a system that is supportive to the planet, that is supportive to the smallholder farmers, a system that can provide healthy food without compromising the resources of the planet, like soil, and the system that rebuilds the greatest resource we have in agriculture, that is the soil. So that shaped my path.
And, in your time observing that the farm of your parents and also your farm, have you seen big changes in inputs and approaches, and what have you seen change over the time observing that, or has it been relatively constant?
There's been a change since we started growing crops. Since I was young, sometimes we could go to the market and buy seeds, especially maize seed. We could go to the shop and buy like beans and plant. But also in terms of soil management, definitely we relied so much on local manures and the like, but we never ever focused so much on the interaction, on the science behind all this. It's kind of the traditional system of farming that we grow crops together. We intercrop, because I come from the banana coffee farming system, where we grow bananas together with fruit trees and coffee all in the same piece of land. But this is the traditional farming system. And I never, since I was young, I never understood the interaction. But as I grew up, I also studied agronomy. I studied soil science. I came to understand why we should do what we are doing, what we have been doing for so long, why we should preserve the farming systems that foster interaction. So in the end, I have also invested quite a lot of knowledge, a lot of energy in maintaining this system, but also making it better, introducing new trees on the farm, native trees that are also supportive to the agroforestry system, also setting up compost areas, and also planning the farm pretty well to have some plots resting and regenerating, and also to go for zero tillage or minimum tillage practices on the farm. However small the farm is, but it's now the microclimate has greatly improved. The use of compost and also the number of trees on the farm have greatly improved. And also now we no longer buy seeds from the market. We produce all the seeds we need on the farm, like also and planting materials, like for sweet potatoes, for beans, maize or corn, banana planting materials. So we keep everything on the farm, unless we find a variety of bananas or a variety of coffee that we don't have already on the farm, and it's on another farm. Then we can talk to another farmer to exchange and get this other local variety of a product that we need. So it's now the farm is almost self-sustaining. So this has been the most important change. And also learning more about regenerative agriculture, about agroecology, about sustainable food systems from other farmers, from the different areas where I have worked, where I've interacted with farmers managing regenerative farms. I also come back to educate my parents, to discuss with them why we should continue doing the good work that we do. So that has been the biggest change. And now another important thing is the involvement of the whole family. So it become a truly family farm with all my sisters. We work together, we manage things together, we take decisions together, and also we share the produce together. So that has been the most important change, and much less external labor being used on the farm, because in many cases we leave plots of land under fallow, and we don't invest a lot of money in cultivating it. So those have been some of the changes that have happened and that I've observed.
When you decided to study agronomy, and I don't know at the time You say when I was young, you're still relatively young. But when you decided to study agronomy in Uganda, was that the traditional agronomy, traditional meaning how you were used to farm, or was it the highly intensive, let's say, industrial agriculture agronomy? How was the agronomy study you did? Was it a challenge, or was it really finding out, like you said, starting to study why you did certain things the way you were doing it anyway? Or was it a bit of a clash with how you were used to farm?
It's a bit of a clash. When I went to to study agronomy at the university, because all my time I wanted to be a farmer, I wanted to be in the agriculture profession, and also when I was at school, I wanted to I made a big change. I wanted to make a big change in the way school gardens are managed, not to be a punishment, but to be an interest oriented activity that young people can go to learn how to farm, because I love farming. My parents made me love farming. And I know it's a very important activity. But when I went to study agronomy at the school, I realized that most of the agricultural education in institutions in academic institutions like the universities was bent towards promoting industrial agribusiness, industrial chemical-based conventional farming systems. And to my shock...
Must have been such a joy for you to study there. No, I'm joking.
To my shock, everything we studied was about... most of the things we studied were about the chemicals that work with the hybrid seeds. It was about how much fertilizers you apply per acre or per hectare, and most of the education was around there. And also while I was at the university, because the university was the agriculture education system in the universities has always been inspired by the Green Revolution, new hybrids, intensive industrial farming systems, and high-tech kind of production systems. When I was at the university, I got involved in this project that was promoting a hybrid seed, a new hybrid seed that had been developed by then, and we were demonstrating and trying it out in western parts of the country around Changkwanzi district, and we were convinced that this is truly the agriculture of the future. This is the agriculture that Africa or the whole world needs. We need that we were. It kind of indoctrinated, but when we worked with the,
I was going to use the word brainwashed, but you did it. Yes. So that's yeah, I was doubting about it. But that's and then how did the bubble burst? How did the
it
bubble?
It was in 2000. What happened? In 2007 that I was involved in the outreach program for this for this project, and this maize was any other new maize varieties developed in Africa and other parts of the world. It was the promises were really high yielding, drought resistant, nutritious, and all these kind of things that it will be the one to take farmers out of poverty. And the most important thing was it was drought resistant, like it can survive in the harsh tropical conditions. But the bubble burst when we asked farmers to take up this maize and they planted, because it also came with a long list of agrochemicals that you have to plant with diammonium phosphate, that is DAP. You have to do at knee height, you have to do top dressing of urea, and you have to add NPK at the tasseling stage. So all these kind of things which we told the farmers, and the farmers had to dig deep into their pockets to get the chemicals to invest in this, and we were all convinced this is something that will help them. But in the end, we were hit by a drought in 2007, and the rain which we expected never came, and it was the test of how to
the drought resistance.
Yes, yeah. it was a very big test, and we got a lot of complaints that the maize is failing, farmers are losing. So maize, many of the fields were drying at a knee height, even after investing in chemical fertilizers, investing in the seeds, investing in the foliar fertilizers. Farmers were not getting anything out of that because of the drought. So I was asked to go and check what is happening, to check to the ground, what the truth behind the claims that it's not working. And I was shocked reaching the farmers' fields, and I could see the sense, the disappointment. And being from a family of farmers, I imagined if it was on our farm that we had subjected all our farm on to one single crop and it's failing, and we had put all our eggs in one basket and it's now all broken. So I started imagining this, and as farmers explained to me, I had these imaginations, and I was wondering what is the fallback position for these farmers? How are they going to feed their families? Where are they going to get money to pay the credit? They took fertilizers on credit. They took agrochemicals from the chemical shops on credit. How are they going to pay the credit? So this emotionally touched me, and I said, maybe this is not the right path for our African agriculture. Maybe the real path is to go back to our diversified farming systems, like the one I imagined, the one we have on our farm, where we have, even if the coffee fails, we still get the bananas, we still get the vegetables, we still have the fruits, and we have the sweet potatoes, and this kind we cannot really suffer in a heavy drought. And this is the traditional African farming system. So I went back to the university in disappointment. I explained to my supervisor, and I said, I don't think I can continue working with this system. I don't think I can continue follow this project. I will need to do something else. And towards the end of 2007, I went back to the community. I went back to the farmers. I told them, I'm no longer with the project, but do not be angry with me. I want us to see how we can change things. We started talking about reviving our traditional farming systems. We started talking about the importance of intercropping, the importance of diversity, the importance if farmers had planted five different crops on their farms, they would not be suffering as much as they suffered by then. So this is when I started rethinking the whole education I was getting from the university, and I started looking out for more knowledge sources, for more knowledge on biodiversity, on like agroforestry, starting to read more about that, and also asking a few professors who are working on soil productivity, how we can build soil productivity without chemicals. Then I started learning more about organic agriculture, about regenerative agricultural systems. So that's also, and in early 2008, that's also when I contacted, I was searching, and I came across Slow Food, and I contacted the Slow Food Foundation for Biodiversity, because I was feeling so much alone in the university, and I was like working on this alone, and I started looking out on who else is doing this kind of work. So this is when I got in touch with the Slow Food Foundation, and I was much welcomed and invited to Terra Madre, where I found a very big family, a very big world of people thinking the same, people actually doing the same, people changing the food system with concrete examples of communities, of projects, of initiatives. And I never stepped back. And it also gave me a lot of energy to improve our family farm. I came back from Taramadre 2008 with a lot of energy, with a lot of enthusiasm, with a lot of knowledge. And I went straight back to work. I went to the communities. I went back to our family farm. I went back to the university and started talking about a different form of agriculture. As a leader at the university, I created another outreach program for our faculty, for the students to, in the holidays, to go out to the communities to learn more about diversified farming systems, to talk about landscape approach towards agroecosystems management. And this has kept me going until now, and it gave me a lot of energy. And I started working in the organic sector, in the organic agriculture, when I left the university, but also working with the communities, working on my school gardening project and building more slow food communities. And this is how I changed my mind, and I don't regret. And it's one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life, to jump out of this sinking ship and support communities, rebuild and regenerate their agricultural systems.
And we're going to get into slow food in a second, because I think many people know, but also many people don't really know what slow food is. But first, a question practically now. On the ground at the university, is there an agroecology department? Is there more attention for the non-sinking ships, let's say the thriving ship, or is the university still in the same direction in let's say part of the sinking part of agriculture and food? Or don't know? Have you been in touch with
the university? Yes, I've been in touch with the university, but not only that university, not only Makerere University, but I've been in touch also with so many other universities, because also one of my goals is to change the education system when it comes to food and agriculture. So that is also part of my goal. In 2012, when Carlo Petrini visited Uganda, we had a seminar at the university in the same university in Makerere, and this is also an indication that that the university had become now more and more open to the different form of knowledge, the regenerative agriculture knowledge, the agroecological knowledge, but also it's facing a lot of competition from other universities who have even created specific courses or degree courses on agroecology, on regenerative agriculture. And also in the university has worked on a collaboration together with institutions like the National Organic Agriculture Movement of Uganda, civil society organizations, to start a summer school on organic agriculture. So that summer school ran for quite some time, and I facilitated also a session in that summer school, because this is we worked with some professors, and this is what we wanted for people to, in the university, students, agriculture students, not only to learn about conventional agriculture, but also to start thinking about organic agriculture. So there has been quite also a lot of research on agroecology at the Agriculture Research Institute, the University Agriculture Research Institute, where there is a small department, not really well developed, not very big, but working on the bioeconomy, like vermicompost and other organic inputs. So other universities like Uganda Matters University, has also created the African Center of Excellence for organic, for agroecology and organic agriculture, also Mountains of the Moon University. Also, they have started a master's degree program in agroecology. So it's really changing a lot because many, many people are now realizing agroecology or regenerative agriculture approaches very, very important, especially in the changing climate and also in the with the growing destruction of the planet. We need to move away from the destructive production systems, from the destructive knowledge systems in agriculture to more regenerative systems and sustainable ones.
And then, I mean, it sounds like in Uganda itself, but also in East Africa and the whole continent, obviously, there's more than enough work to do also for you. But you decided to become much more active in Slow Food International and at some point become vice president and even president. What motivated you to step up this role on the activist side and not only on the farming and the agronomy and education side?
The good thing is that my role in Slow Food, even starting from a convivium leader and being a local Slow Food chapter leader back in 2008, late 2008 to early 2009, it also gave me more opportunities to reach out to more farmers, to learn more and explain more and demonstrate more to the farmers the food system that we want, the good, clean and fair food system. The most important thing to note is that despite the leadership role that I have, it does not affect negatively my practical involvement in farming activities, in training activities with the farmers. It actually gives me more space, more opportunities, and a bigger opportunity to interact with more farmers and to share this inspiration practically. So climbing up the ladder of leadership in Slow Food is part of the big picture. It's part of the big job that I have to do, that I'm committed to do, as a leader to inspire, but also as a leader to demonstrate practically what food system we need. And it also adds to the voice to talk to the policymakers, because it's not always enough to do things in isolation and say, yes, we are changing the system, but we are only changing the farms. We also need to talk to the policymakers. We need to talk to the research institutions. We need to talk to the universities, which are creating also a lot of trouble by going into promoting the conventional knowledge systems. We need to talk to a lot of people, and in many cases, you need a leadership role to talk to these people. You need this. I don't want to say the position, but you need the voice.
It helps.
Yeah, it helps a lot to communicate to them. Today, since my election as the president of Slow Food, I've had a chance to meet quite a lot of leaders here in Uganda alone that I always wanted to meet, but I never had an audience with them. So I've had meetings with many members of parliament. I've been invited to meet different ministers of foreign delegations. I've been invited to talk to the university chancellors and to the Ministry of Agriculture. We've set up relationships. And now also I'm one of the big voices here in Uganda talking to the ministry to push for the National Agroecology Strategy. So all the meetings, they want me to be there. because I represent a global network. I represent a global voice. I represent a network of millions of actors out there who are working every day to change the food system. So this is why it's important to share the inspiration, not only to work in isolation and say, okay, I'm concentrating on my farm because I want my farm to change. Of course, I do a lot of farming. I get a lot of time when I'm in the country to try out things on the farm, because an agroecology farm or a regenerative farm teaches you new things every day. You get to see new interactions. You get to learn new ways plants behave. You get to learn to see new plants coming up in terms of biodiversity. So I also take a lot of time to observe my family farm and work there. But also I take a lot of time to go to the communities to share with them, to learn more from them, and also take a lot of time to go to talk to the policymakers and to talk to the global community. So in the end, it's a very big opportunity to influence not only the actions of producers, the actions of farmers, the actions of vendors on the streets and in the markets, but also to influence the policies and programs of government and the direction of agriculture education.
And speaking on that policy piece, what are they looking for when you talk to members of parliament, when you talk to delegations that visit Uganda, also in general, because you do a lot of international work as well? What is, because I don't think many of us listeners get the chance often to speak to people in that kind of, I don't want to say power, but that kind of position. And we always say, oh, policies should change, which is very easy to say, very difficult to do. And what in those conversations, of course, without naming names, but what are they looking for? Is it, because they get, of course, bombarded from another side as well with very good presentations, a very strong lobby influences on the agrochemical industry to, like, let's not change course because we're all going to starve and all those things. Let's say the lobby from another food system is very strong, and then they talk to you as well. What are they looking to learn, and what do they need more of us? Like, do they need more stories, more case studies, more numbers, more research? Like, what can we do to influence that when you're in those closed meetings or those conversations with policymakers? What are they mostly looking for or wondering?
One thing that I have realized doing this job is that there's been quite a lot of greenwashing. The lobbies have been very strong for so long, and there are quite a lot of policymakers who are looking at scale. Scale in terms of producing too much, but they never ever understand the realities of people on the ground. So what we are bringing on the table is the reality of the situation on the ground, and also looking at how
they need to have like an experience like you had with the hybrid seeds and the input and then the shock of the drought.
There are so many of these experiences out there, and they are all suffocated. They don't have a voice. They don't have a platform. So one thing...
But of course, if you're in your office and in your air-conditioned car, you're not going to ever see that or feel that or sense that, because your food just going to arrive and there's no question.
And some policymakers only go back to their communities during the time of looking for votes and campaigns and they don't get a chance to see this. So one thing that we have done even during the GMO campaign to stop the GMO bill was to bring farmers to parliament and accredit them as observers and exploit all these legal opportunities that are out there. So farmers come to talk to the members of parliament, come to talk to the different policymakers about what experiences they already have with the hybrid seeds, and also expressing what challenges they are facing with the industrial production system. So we bring in real life experiences, we bring in the concept of communities, and also the real solutions, not the false solutions. And we have to count on the shortcomings of the big agribusiness industries to the communities, to the people. Yes, farmers, the governments are looking at figures like GDP, the contribution of agriculture to the total national GDP. But again, what we have to look at is how the share of the GDP, the agriculture GDP, affects the communities. It doesn't make a lot of sense to produce, to evict 1,000 families to produce a lot of coffee for export, and then we say the agriculture has counted to more income, but again more poverty has been created by the same need to earn foreign exchange. So we bring out all these cases, and the truth is many policymakers, they get shocked hearing all these stories, and they feel how much they have betrayed and neglected the communities, the societies, because many times they listen to the beautiful presentations that also come with a lot of kickbacks, financial kickbacks from the big agricultural industries, as they want to take over the seed system, they want to take over the land, they want to take over the fish from the lakes. And then many times the voice of those who are affected doesn't really come out very well. So even going beyond the local policymakers, we also talk about the international or regional governments, like to the East African Community, to African Union. So when we have a chance, we also make clear demonstration of how Africa can feed itself, how communities are feeding themselves. It's not always only about earning money for the government, but it's also about feeding the growing population and giving the power for the growing population to feed itself, not to get someone, American or Dutch company coming and take over land and produce and say we are feeding Africa. No. This is not, on paper it looks like, yes, they are producing a lot to feed Africa, but it's not feeding anyone. It's actually creating more problems. It's creating more starving. It's creating more pollution, more environmental problems, which affect more and more and more communities in the rural and urban areas. So these are some of the realities. The most important thing is that when we talk to the policymakers, we bring out the realities, which they may not have had access to. Also, when talking to other people outside Africa, like when I'm in Europe, I actually bring in all my experience from the 30 or more African countries where I've worked, experiences from the communities, also analyzing the bilateral policies in relation to the common person, and how these bilateral policies are actually driving more poverty in African communities. Instead of eliminating poverty, they are actually extending the imperialistic trade policies and relationships, and creating more and more problems. But you have to speak this out for people to understand. Many times they may have not had access to this in-depth information, because a lot of information is not in the books. A lot of wrong information is in policy papers and books, but not all this true information is out there. The real information is with communities, and that's why at Slow Food we work a lot with communities to amplify the voice of the communities, for communities to speak for themselves and to speak directly to the policymakers. It's very, very important.
Yeah, we've seen that also in the US with Regenerate America, a big push to get at least soil into the Farm Bill, the most powerful thing It seems there was to bring real farmers to Congress and to have them testify and share their real experiences and all the challenges they have. And I think it's the same in Brussels. It's the same in Kampala. It's the same in Accra. It's the same in any capital. The distance between the political institutions and also the academic institutions. We've had quite a few scientists here that stepped out of the system because they simply couldn't do the research that really was necessary, or they saw in the fields with farmers they were working with things that, according to the university or according to their books, wasn't possible. So there's a huge disconnect there, and we always say just you need to go and visit the farmers and visit the communities and see for yourself and listen and learn there, which of course is very difficult if you're in an office writing policy papers. But on terms of the regeneration piece and regenerative agriculture, you mentioned it a few times, and you really specifically picked for Terra Madre, which is your of Slow Food, the big biannual, and will be next year again, but we were there last year in 2022 in Turin, a very big fair conference gathering, and you picked the theme of regenerate. Are you scared of the big agrochemical companies? Because I've seen a few already starting to use regeneration. Like, look, you need only this chemical to regenerate. Or look, you need this kind of lobby and greenwashing or regenerative washing or whatever we want to call it is starting to also enter the policy lobby again. Like, yeah, of course, this is nice, the soil. But if you only use this and this input, you'll be fine. Do you see that already or not so much yet? Because I've seen some early signs of it.
Yes, I've seen that already, because the big big agribusiness corporations, they always love greenwashing and jumping to hijack the concepts that are really
not the outcome, but yeah,
they want to hijack the concept. They want to hijack the terms, the concept, but the outcomes are very different, because for them, and also their goals are different. For them, their goal is not to regenerate the planet. The goal is to make more and more money and also expand their income sources and exercise more control using that concept. So we are much, much aware of that, and that's also they employ a very big PR tool. They employ a lot of marketing systems to completely change the meaning of the concept in there towards what they want, and also they want to change the whole outcome towards their business model, selling more and more inputs and creating more and more dependence on their custom inputs. So yes, we see this, and that's why part of our strategic goals is education, and not only educating in schools, but educating communities on the true regeneration, on the regeneration we want as Slow Food, and the regeneration the planet wants. It's not the regeneration that chemical companies want. So it's very, very different. So looking at regenerative agriculture, we are focusing on regeneration that is in favor of local resources, of self-sustaining farms, and also regeneration that is actually community-led and community-managed, and regeneration that also respects the dignity of young people, the dignity of women farmers, and regeneration that respects the rights and dignity of indigenous peoples. So these and also a regenerative system that is not based on external inputs, but it's based on biodiversity, based on local knowledge, and the knowledge of the producers, of the farmers, and it's based on the local food systems. So this is the difference from the kind of hijack the big agribusiness or input companies they are focusing on, because for them it's all about creating more inputs that farmers can depend on stopping farmers from thinking and from innovating, and from their intention is to break the circular flow of resources on the farm, such that farmers will always have to run to their inputs. So, but this is not the regeneration we want.
And do you see a role for larger companies, and I'm not saying agrochemical industry, but let's say larger companies, and if so, are you helping them as well with Slow Food International? I know with like Terra Madre, of course, you have some larger sponsors, the Lavazza's, a very big coffee brand of this world, and for sure you get approached by companies. Do you engage with that? Is that a role you take as Slow Food? And is that something you see in this regenerative transition, that there is a role for larger companies to play?
The Slow Food we are talking about today is open and inclusive. We are open to partnerships for those people who truly want to regenerate the planet, who truly want to...
How do you test that when somebody knocks on the door? Like, what's the filter?
Yeah, large companies actually keep knocking on the door and say we want to, like coffee companies, especially through our very successful coffee coalition project. Large companies keep knocking on the door and say we want to support more farmers. They are not only focusing on the product, they're also focusing on the origin of the product. This is one big quality of those we are working with. This is also one of the most important things. It's not only to focus on coffee. I want to use the example of coffee because this is where we have had a successful story, like a success story of working with some of these companies. It's not focusing on the coffee when it arrives in Europe or in Italy or in United States. It's about going back to the communities and say we want to support community-led regenerative agriculture. We want to support communities to do agroecology. We want to support communities to build agroforestry systems, to build the resilience, build the resilient mountain ecosystem projects. And we start with that. And it's there is a lot of transparency. There is a mutual support, and the most important thing is that the focus is on supporting those who actually do most of the work but they have always been the least
took most of the risk as
yes,
well.
They have took they have taken most of the risks, but they have always had the least reward at the entire value chain. So this is why we do not only focus on the outcome. We have to focus on focusing on the people, focusing on the communities, focusing on ecosystems, focusing on biodiversity, on resources, before we focus on the outcome of the entire collaboration. So the Slow Food we are talking about is not the Slow Food of closed doors. If anyone knocks on the door, we of course there is always room for discussion on how truly you want to support the regeneration of the planet. It's not we are much aware of the greenwashing. We are aware of what is happening globally, and only companies they want to use the regeneration as a marketing strategy, as a part of their PR. But we are aware of all these greenwashing strategies. So that's why we are also very careful when we are going through the process. So the large companies Of course, like you said, not talking about the input companies, the agrochemical companies, but large companies have a very important role to play, to rethink their production systems, to rethink their programs, to rethink their business model towards a truly regenerative one, and towards one that supports the communities. We are, even in when we set up seed banks, like here in Uganda, where communities have set up indigenous seed banks, they have been approached by local seed companies. Some of them are big, others are small, and they say, okay, we want to bring back the local vegetable seeds on the market. I mean, on the market as part of our seed catalog. But we want to collaborate with a women group or with an indigenous seed bank to multiply these, to supply us with the seeds on a quarterly basis or annual basis, that we can pack and sell and tell the story of this seed of this community, how they are preserving biodiversity. So we evaluate the system and we get back to the roots of the community. We, like I said, it all comes back to the people. It comes back to the community. It comes back to the resources, and not only the outcome or the output as seeds, but who is really producing this and what struggles are they going through? Which kind of social and environmental injustices are they enduring, and how can we support them to bring about fairness and to support the work they do, to continue this work they do, and to truly communicate their work? So it's not that we are. It's not that there is no room for talks with relatively big companies which want to rethink their production and business models. Their window is there, and they have a big role to play in supporting regenerative agriculture. There are those companies which are investing in agroecology business models and supporting agroecology entrepreneurs and with capital startups and many other. There are banks regional banks which are now starting to focus on supporting agroecology entrepreneurs with low interest loans, because they are convinced that they now believe that we need to support healthy food systems. They are worried about what is going on in the world, and they are worried about the fragility of the industrial system. So these all need to be supported to transform their business model towards a more regenerative and agroecological one. But of course, we are much aware of the greenwashing that could happen along the way. And
And what would you do? This is a perfect bridge to a question I love to ask. What would you do if tomorrow morning you weren't in charge of Slow Food International, but you were in charge of $1 billion to be put to work? So definitely on the investing side, but it could be extremely long-term investments if you want. It could be no return or very little return. It could be any flexibility you want, but you basically have, I'm not saying unlimited resources, but a very significant one. I'm asking this question not because I want to hear exact dollar amounts, but I'm always curious from people on the ground, what would they prioritize? What would they focus on if they had a crazy amount of money to put to work, like $1 billion? In your case, what would you focus on?
This is a tricky one, but it's...
That's why I don't
ask. It's what we pray for: Slow Food to have $1 billion, or me to have $1 billion to invest. And I would definitely invest in the. I would put it in impact investment, like to invest in.
Would you focus on seeds or on compost or the input side, on education, technology?
I would, because the world is crazy with profit. the world has gone so wrong with the need for profit, and greed keeps multiplying because companies want more profit, and when you have more profit, you have more power. But what we are looking for is impact to the communities, impact in terms of the change to the environment, to regenerate the planet, regenerate the environment, to redesign the destroyed mountain ecosystems towards more ecological ones. So I would invest in the communities in terms of preserving and multiplying more local and indigenous diverse seeds, and also I would invest in the impact of indigenous peoples in protecting territories, and something that would not bring back the monetary profits, but will bring back profits in terms of sustainability to the planet, and also like bringing more life to the planet. This is the kind of impact investment I'm thinking about. Investing more in agroecology, in communities that are working on agroecology, building agroecology businesses, farmers markets, that would improve the healthy of the food system, that would reduce the ecological impact of food on the planet. This is where money needs to go right now. This is where the 1 billion needs to be spent, not to spend this 1 billion on high tech lab meat or high tech like seeds like GMOs and new GMOs. No, this is where we need to. With all the money in those investments, need to be pulled out and sent to the communities to support more with to impact oriented community initiatives that have impact on positive impact on people's health, on the planet, on the ecosystem, that can rebuild soils and that can clean the watersheds and water systems, and that can have a lasting impact on the food security, like and food sovereignty. That is local and based in specific territories. So this is where money needs to go.
And what would you do is another question I always like to ask. You no longer, unfortunately, are in charge of the $1 billion, but you do have the power to change one thing overnight, the magic wand question I like to ask. So if you could change one thing and one thing only overnight, what would that be?
I would stop GMOs.
And why is that the intervention point you choose it, instead of agrochemical inputs or anything else? What's the angle there? What's the reasoning there?
Because it's clear that GMOs not only increase the need to develop new agrochemicals, but also they take away sovereignty of a lot of people to feed themselves. So one of the reasons why we still have quite many agrochemicals being developed, the glyphosate use has more than doubled, and all the environmental challenges with the chemicals, they have come as a result of seed modification. The more new seeds, from the super hybrids to GMOs, you develop, the more need for a long list of recommended chemical inputs for better production and to realize the potential of those seeds. But again, That is one part, because if you focus only on agrochemicals and you let the need for agrochemicals continue to grow, it becomes inevitable. So it's better to prevent the need to work on the preventive side, to focus on cutting the demand than stopping the supply. So when there is no demand, not a lot of demand,
the supply will go.
Yeah. So that is one thing. But also when we are focusing on enslavement of farmers, especially smallholder farmers in the global south, who always don't have enough money to reinvest in buying new seeds every season, GMOs are bound to create more and more challenges. Recently, in Uganda, there is something which is actually happening in Uganda today, because the seed companies for maize, for corn, they said they may not be able to supply maize seed for this season. So in just a statement like this, the price for maize seed, the hybrid maize seed,
has exploded.
It has increased by more than 100%. So the cost of a hybrid maize seed last year, the average, like DK, the one which is imported from Kenya, was at 10,000 Uganda shillings. That's roughly $3 a kilo. Because this maize, the companies are not going to supply this maize seed this season, now one kilo of this maize has gone to 50,000 Uganda shillings. So,
from 10 to 50, just for our people listening and taking notes, that's 5x. Yeah.
In parts like northern Uganda, which are hard to access, which are very far away from the central, and there are long lines of people now fighting to stock the maize seed. So this shows that if people develop the high dependence on external inputs, a time will come when all these seed companies merge into one and say, we are not supplying maize seed until so such and such a condition is met. And this will risk a lot of lives. This is already risking a lot of lives. A lot of famine, a lot of hunger is bound to happen just because a seed company is not willing or not able to supply maize seed. This is not going to happen in communities where people have already saved their seeds from the indigenous or local maize seed. And already in our communities, people have started sharing the seeds. And this is the biggest threat GMOs and new hybrids and new conventional breeding systems have on the livelihoods of people. This is why if I had the power, I would stop this system of always developing new high-tech seeds and support the preservation and protection of local biodiversity and revive our local seeds, support communities to build seed banks and have seeds and improve on seed sovereignty, as well as removing and eliminating all the seed laws in the world that are meant only to protect corporations and take away the right of farmers or local people to share and exchange seeds. This is a very big thing, because once someone touches the seed, they are directly touching the food system. Once they control the seed, they are directly controlling how people should feed themselves and how people should access food, because everything starts with the seed.
And would you then, sort of retrospectively looking at the 1 billion, the question I asked before, and focus that all on seeds? Is that a fair, or is that again the mono-reductionist monoculture view of we need everything under the umbrella to change, of course, but would here you're arguing seeds is the most important entry point. Without that, yes, where everything yes else is, I would in say, the, sort of irrelevant.
In terms of investment, seed banks and the impact on biodiversity protection, that would be one of the, it would be,
and developing new seeds based on old seeds, but also like figuring out and scaling, because all the traditional seed companies have been bought up by a few now. Like we're almost left without any seed companies that do proper work.
Because they are not focusing on impact, they are focusing on profit, the monetary gain. But the seed banks are focusing on impact, the community seed banks. Protection and preservation of biodiversity is not focusing on monetary profit. It's focusing on the environmental impact, on the social impact of, this is where money needs to go, to invest in the social impact of the work of the communities. So protecting seeds, building seed banks, many of the seed banks are not focusing on the monetary impact. They're actually focusing on the social and environmental impact. They're focusing on food sovereignty, and they are not.
And have you seen examples that are set up as a company? I'm not saying for the highest profit, but as a for-profit company, or at least a break-even company. Let's say, have you seen models where this is a sustainable company structure? Of course, not focused on crazy profits, but at least to pay your own bills, to be also there again, independent from outside sources of capital or grants, etc.
Definitely, seed banks multiply and keep seeds and sell seeds to at a reasonable price to those who want the seeds. Like also recently, like I talked about the maize scandal, the maize seed mm-hmm scandal from DK, which is I think also Monsanto subsidiary here in East Africa. They are the ones who are not going to supply seed because they want people to suffer and government pass policies in their favor. But on the contrary, we have a civil society like a communication page, WhatsApp, where we have farmers, where we have people who are working on agroecology and regenerative systems. And once this scandal came up, we said, okay, whoever has indigenous maize seed, please share with the nearby communities, even if it's at a fee. And you realize that most of the people who have the local maize seed, they are actually selling. They are not just giving it out for free. Like there are some seed banks which have like a ton of seeds. They have worked so hard over the past years to multiply this maize.
It should be rewarded.
And they are actually selling at half the price of the old price. They are selling a kilo at 5,000, which is very, very reasonable, because they calculated that it could offset the costs and maintain the seed bank, and they can reinvest this money into multiplying more and more seeds. It's like giving away, but at a cost. So, because they have this not only to make crazy abnormal profits, but also to make an impact, to build seed sovereignty, but also to meet the costs of the work that they do, because they have to build premises, they have to invest in seed preservation methods like cooling systems, and they have to buy more and more solar systems to generate the energy they use in the underground cooling systems. So definitely the cost is reasonable. It's not out of speculation.
What would be the message to the financial or to investors? Let's say we do this at Terra Madre next year in front of an audience, and there's quite a few people from Milan, from London, from Kampala, from New York that are in a position of resources or in position of investing at some point. What would be your main Of course, we're going to enlighten them and talk about real case studies and real the issues and challenges of farming in the current system. And so they will learn a lot. But if they have to remember one thing from our session on stage, what would that be?
I would the message I would send out to investors is to think about impact investment, first of all, in the food system. Impact investment in communities, in environmental and in ecological production systems, and also investment in non-destructive technologies like food preservation in the global south, where we still have a lot of food losses and food waste due to inadequate value addition and preservation methods. And so this is an area of investment that where they could invest a lot of they could invest resources, but most importantly focus on impact investment in food sovereignty, in agroecology, and environmental protection for the communities.
And as a final question, have you seen something change in terms of discussions, conversations? You mentioned a lot of large companies are knocking on the door of Slow Food. I mean, you've been president now for a bit. Like, has anything shifted? Because, of course, the worry with large companies as well is they just do it for the greenwashing. They do a nice project somewhere on the side, but they don't really, let's say, decommodify deeply internally. Have you seen a shift in attention and real interest in this type of deep regeneration that we talk about here, or not yet? Are we still early on?
I think it's early to tell, but the companies which, like I will still come back to the Coffee Coalition and also the Wine Coalition, and very soon we need to involve people dealing in other, like companies dealing in other products. One thing is about the changes in the communication, not only to treat coffee as a commodity, but as a food product. This is part of the change, but it's too early to tell. But also the focus on community and also the producer support systems and the transparency in the procurement. These are some of the early signs of change which we are following up. But of course, we have to follow up more and track the impact of our actions on these companies, and also the impact of our collaboration with them. So I can say the Coffee Coalition project is in its very early stages, but it's very promising. It also involves companies that are making like coffee machines, companies that are making, like, working at the entire value chain of coffee. Also locally, there are coffee companies which are now focusing on specific local varieties or indigenous varieties which never mattered to them before. And now they are promoting them and creating specific value chains. This is a very big impact on protecting coffee biodiversity. So, thanks to the Coffee Coalition and the collaboration we have with these companies, they start opening up to communities which are still keeping and protecting indigenous coffee varieties, and they create special focus on them, create special attention, and it's the communities become proud of protecting biodiversity, and it's a win for the for the planet.
Hey, I always end up asking another follow-up question after the final question, and this is no different. Are you hopeful, given your journey from a diverse farm, which is now much more diverse, of course, and I hope to visit at some point, but let's say a diverse farm into a very traditional industrial agronomy, and then getting hit by a drought and let's say seeing the non-shiny brochure side of things and going deep into agroecology and now to slow food, like what, seeing both, all sides of agriculture and food, are you hopeful for, and of course at the same time seeing all the challenges of climate, of colonization, of commodification, seeds, etc. Are you hopeful for the future of food and agriculture?
I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful for the future because, like I said, a lot of people are coming to realize that the future of food, the future of agriculture is not in the industrial global agribusiness corporations anymore. It's in the regenerative systems. It's in the protection of the resources, protection of biodiversity, and also in the support of smallholder farmers. So governments can report big incomes, but at the same time, poverty levels rising. And this shows that there is a problem somewhere. The increase in food prices, given that, given the increase, the large expansion of monocultural farms, is also an indication of the failure of the system. The climate change and the destruction of the resources, forests, wetlands, is also part of the failure of the industrial system, and many people are now thinking on how do we counteract this. So I'm really, really hopeful that things are changing for the better, and things will eventually change for the better.
Thank you so much for ending this conversation with that hopeful message. Not that it wasn't a hopeful one, a hopeful conversation, but it's always good to end like that. And thank you so much for the work you do. And of course, with the full team of Slow Food, which many people don't realize is not a large organization. It's a large movement with activities and ways to get involved everywhere from Uganda, like you did, but from almost anywhere you live, you can get involved. I will put the links definitely below in the show notes and in description so you can get involved too. And of course, come to Terra Madre, which I think will be autumn next year. So it's every 2 years. So it will be, whenever you're listening to this, it will be 2024. If you can, because I've been multiple times and it's always an amazing experience. And for you, it was also a transformational one. So thank you so much for coming on here, share about your journey, and of course, for the work you do.
Thank you too for hosting me and also for the interesting discussion we had today.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.